From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Today's episode is a weird one on many levels. First, it's weird that we have not done a podcast on this before. We've had a lot of people ask us about it over the years. Secondly, it concerns something that has always fascinated us, allegations of hidden technology. Now, you know these stories, or you know the rough tropes. They come and go throughout the world of conspiratorial lore, but they will never really go away just because there are way too many known, proven cases of suppressed technology. We've explored it on the show. And there's way too much other weird, somewhat sinister, circumstantial, very true stuff floating around, like the Invention Secrecy Act of, 1951? That's a real thing. I'm still boggled by that. You can invent something in the United States and do everything right, and the government can totally not just steal your invention, but also legally prevent you from ever talking about it.
Can you imagine getting that visit or that call? You're so stoked. You've patented your first like gangbusters genius idea. And then you get a call from the G-Men saying, sorry, but we're going to suppress the hell out of this and you can never speak of it again.
You know, it's not the government's fault. They were just there two decades before and already patented the thing. And just, you know, they didn't have to tell anybody. Obviously.
Oh, so it's parallel thinking with the government.
Yeah, exactly.
I spend a little too much time, I think, whenever we get close to these topics, just imagining what sort of stuff could have been pulled by the Invention Secrecy Act. I hope it's not all weapons. I hope it's some things that are like ridiculous, like a regenerative dentifrice, a toothpaste you can use that actually removes cavities. And someone was like, no, this the world's not ready. Lock him up.
Just a way too advanced bidet. You know, we can't have this. We cannot let this fly. No.
Yeah, an actually everlasting gobstopper.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wallpaper where the snozzberries actually taste like snozzberries.
Yes, yes. Or a pill that means you'll never have to sleep again. That's my personal favorite. Anyway, this stuff happens all the time.
They have that.
That's called meth.
No. There's a trailer dropping for a show on the day we record this about a very, very pill. It's actually more of a mind app, but it's all good.
Nice. Can you disclose more?
Sure. It's called Tomorrow's Monsters. It's brought to you by the Flynn Picture Company and Dan Bush and Psychopia Pictures and myself and my team.
So it's awesome. A documentary is what you're saying.
It's a documentary, yeah.
Our very own Matt Frederick. Yeah, that's an exciting one, and we're not blowing smoke. Do check it out. I think we'll have the trailer for that show in our own feed in a little while, but stay
you
tuned.
You betcha.
Stay tuned. So, suppressed technology. Let's start today's story with a little bit of background on the U.S. Navy. Here are the facts.
So we could start with the rumors, I suppose. We don't necessarily need to lead off with saying the rumors are true, but there are rumors, tons of them, in fact, about the U.S. Navy and classified space age experiments. These rumors don't exist in a vacuum. They don't come from absolute whole cloth. The Navy has, of course, done tons of secret experiments. It's a thing. It's a known thing that the Navy does experiments that we'll probably never hear about, or at the very least, the full extent of this research. But the stuff that has been declassified is really, really, really cool.
Oh, yeah. And one of the first things we can look at is this amazing piece of tech called the Sea Shadow.
Not to be confused with the sea shanties that are very popular on TikTok right now. Just putting that out there.
No, it's not a sea shanty. It's a sea shadow. It's a stealth warship. It will remind you of if you took one of the stealth bombers or the stealth jet fighter that we've talked about before on the show that you've seen that made their appearances during the Gulf War, I believe. Mm-hmm. like an F-117 Nighthawk. Very similar to that, but you took that thing, then you kind of crunched it down, turned its wings kind of on its side and downwards a bit, and then put it in the water. That's kind of what it looks like.
So a little bit like the X-Wing or the X-Men like plane, sort of.
Yeah, or a B-2 bomber, or I'm going to be completely honest, a real kick-ass toy from the G.I. Joe toy line. It looks like you could buy it at Target and put your little figures in it.
Remember when they used to make toys and then everything else was just based on the toy? Now it's the other way around.
Yeah.
I miss those days.
I love it. I love all the I love the ridiculous extents that we'll go to make a storyline around a toy line. You know what I mean? The Sea Shadow is a real thing. It's created in partnership with Lockheed and DARPA. DARPA, again, if you're listening, get at me. Where's the sleep tech? Not meth. I'm not asking for meth. I just want to stay awake. So the Sea Shadow, it was a project that spanned from like 1984 to its public debut and confirmation of existence in 1993. It looks super cool. It had some really smart technology aboard and in its DNA, you could say. But ultimately, it was never commissioned. In fact, it was gutted and sold by Uncle Sam after they had spent a while trying to get a museum to take it. No museum would take it. So they sold it to a private company with a very weird condition. And so we're selling this to you and you have to destroy it. You have to take it apart. You can never use it or sell it. Just sell it for scrap.
And typically we're not going to hear about this kind of stuff unless the military decides they no longer have any use for it or it's more or less considered a failed experiment, right?
Right. That's a good point. So there are two ways that there are a number of ways militaries will disclose this kind of bleeding edge tech. First, if it doesn't work and they feel like maybe another intelligence agency has already compromised the research. That's why, you know, when enough time passes, that's when you start hearing about stuff like we tried to use bats as explosive devices in World War II, things like that.
Or those hover platforms. Remember those hover platforms with the like propellers on the bottom? That was a real cool idea. Clearly, it was super wonky, impossible to steer, more so than like a Segway. And that came out, you can see drawings of these on the internet.
Mm-hmm. One of those was actually mistaken for a UFO in Mexico a few years back. Actually, I don't think mistaken is right because it was an unidentified flying
aerial
object.
Aerial phenomenon. Yeah. I think that's sort of the old story of where a lot of sightings of UFOs come from is veiled government technology that no one knows about. So therefore, it must be, if we don't know about it, it must be, you know, from another galaxy.
Absolutely. Another reason that a government might disclose bleeding edge tech is to send an intimidation signal to a geopolitical rival.
Mm.
That's a powerful statement. And then there are, of course, legit leaks like the Assanges and Snowdens of the world. But what's interesting about this is although the Sea Shadow is long gone, you can see its influence, its legacy in other ships today, like the USNS Impeccable, an ocean surveillance ship that was recently, or a few years back, I should say, in the news for some ratcheting tensions in the Pacific theater, mainly China, and interacting with US and the Philippines. But so the Sea Shadow, it's a real thing. It looks like a spaceship on the water. And
just to be clear here, the USNS Impeccable looks like that build that we were discussing where it looks like it's got two parts of it on the bottom that go into the water and are submerged really deeply and then kind of goes up in an arc, almost like the underside of a bridge tunnel or something.
Great example.
Yeah, beneath the ship so that other things can go in there. I guess.
Pretty cool. I want one. I want to live on one. But so the Navy also did other wild stuff back in the day, just to show you how long ago this process was. So Sea Shadow, comparatively recent. But the Navy also experimented with airborne aircraft carriers. This is something we covered in an old episode of Car Stuff. For a while, this idea is going to sound crazy, and it's going to sound like It's a conversation that a bunch of coked up 80s movie producers would have. But here's what happened. They said, blimps are cool. We like airships. Let's build airships that we can put tiny planes in. And then we can have these tiny planes fly out of the airships. And then guys, we're gonna put the planes back in the blimps.
Bro, I love that idea, and I love you so much.
Guys, this is the best karaoke night ever. Blimps. But yeah, they did. The USS Akron, the USS Macon, they were lighter than air craft, and they were huge. They were 800 feet long. They had built-in hangars, and they could take these tiny, tiny planes and deploy them. And then the pilots could, in theory, and they did this successfully a few times, they could also return to the airship, dock, and be taken back up into the blimp. But it's like anybody with anxiety, your heart will already start racing when you hear about how they connected back. They had to like fly up under the airship at this match its speed, and they had a little hook on this tiny plane, and they had to kind of like at a carnival game or an arcade game, they had to kind of like position the hook onto this bar that was just hanging down from the blimp. They had to hope it connected and then have perfect timing so that they didn't destroy the whole house of airborne cards. No surprise, eventually eventually Uncle Sam decided this was kind of a wild, unreliable idea for a number of reasons. And we know the Navy also experiments with armament, right? I remember.
Well, wait. Yeah. We can't leave USS Akron yet because we know it exploded, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Let's not bury the lead. Yeah, for sure.
It straight mistakes up exploded.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it didn't fly for very long, but in 1933, that's when its final flight occurred, at least the Akron version we spoke of.
Mm-hmm. It had a number of accidents, yeah. But work in progress. So we also know the Navy experiments extensively with new types of armament, you know, mortar shells and so on. Probably one of the coolest things to hit the public sphere is the railgun, which has been fascinating us for a number of years. Shout out to the railgun crews, because that stuff is supposed to be ready in 2021 to 2025.
Was that Quake?
Yes.
I think it was Quake.
Yes. I was like, am I crazy? Like, I thought that was a weapon in Doom or Quake.
Pretty sure it's Quake.
But this is not a handheld device. This is like a massive ordnance cannon.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. It's not something you can carry around with you yet. In a handheld version.
We don't know. We don't know what they're up to.
Yeah, okay, let's put it that way. It's not something we can carry around in a handheld version. And the Navy has done tons of other stuff. The drawing board is filled with mistakes and triumphs. Of course, you know, Matt, I thought of you specifically with this one. It's maybe a story for another day, but there's a lot of research into unmanned maritime vehicles. Like Lockheed is building those prototypes now.
Like sea drones?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Of course they are. Oh, man. I just haven't seen it. I haven't looked into it. But yeah, find me in a week and I'll be very, very into this.
I always picture, what was that film? I always picture the guys from Step Brothers looking at an unmanned ship of this sort and saying like, wow, once you take the people out, there's so much room for activities.
Yeah, I suppose. But isn't the idea the same way that like laptops now don't have disk drives in them anymore? Aren't they trying to make the smallest possible package to, I guess when you say activities, we're like using that as a stand in for features and yeah, like tech and weaponry, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Fuel, more communications equipment. You also don't have to worry so much about various safety mechanisms you would put in to keep the meat bags going safely port to port.
It's almost as though people are going to one day become an afterthought in all of this stuff.
Maybe. But we are giving you these examples. Again, these very real examples to establish this fact. Yes, The U.S. military constantly engages in classified research, experimentation, and design, and so on and so on and so on. A ton of it ends up never working, but it's also safe to assume, I would say it's crucial to assume, that all competent world-class militaries are doing the same thing. The U.S. is not alone in this regard. It's not a matter of, like, we're beyond good and evil. These are just the rules of the road for these organizations. But in the case of the U.S. Navy specifically, there is one project, gentlemen, one rumor of a test that has obsessed thousands of people for decades. That's our episode today. What is the Philadelphia Experiment?
We'll tell you about it in just a moment.
Here's where it gets crazy. We're back. We don't have to spend a lot of time on this, but we've researched extensively and the facts are there. The Philadelphia Experiment was the original name for what we call cream cheese. It was invented by the U.S. Navy back in the 1950s, shortly after World War II, to address growing and urgent concerns about the lack of cream in wartime cheese supplies.
Those maniacs. They were so preoccupied with whether they could do this, they never considered whether they should.
Yep. And we made a whole video about it. If you head over to youtube.com/conspiracystuff, you can watch that video. And really, it's just the lack of cream in that video is astounding. And it's really what it's all about.
The best part of the video is when they start getting into different flavors. That's when it really, they cracked the egg wide open.
Mm-hmm. The cream cheese arm race. Yeah, the flavor arm race. It was a harrowing time, you know. And I think we can all agree that the world got very close to ending. So thank you. Cream cheese is also, you know, the cream cheese conflict is also where we see the origins of mutually assured destruction or MAD policy, which later you might recognize from nuclear weapons. We're kidding. This is something different. We think we're kidding. I don't know. Big cream. Don't shut us down. What we're really talking about is something that I believe could now be described as an urban legend. It's been around long enough that it's reached legend status. And we have a story for you, folks. Strap in.
Legendary to the point that, you know, kind of like we were talking about earlier with that room of Navy tech people getting a little excited, big upping each other on weird ideas. There was a room full of Hollywood executives doing something very similar, saying the Philadelphia Experiment. Brilliant idea for a sci-fi film of 1984.
That's right. Now, cast your mind back to 1943, October, at the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard. Government scientists are conducting an experiment aboard a U.S. Navy cannon-class destroyer escort called the USS Eldridge. Its number, DE-173.
There are some notable people in attendance at this momentous occasion, one of whom is Albert Einstein.
He was there?
Albert Einstein was making the rounds, according to this story, because, you see, the eggheads working for the Navy had reached some fascinating conclusions about the application of Einstein's theory of the unified field, and they were hoping to create a real-life invisibility cloak, a field of energy that would render the Eldridge invisible both to the human eye and to radar, which was the more important part.
This is sort of like a science-y tech version of like, D&D cloak of invisibility, basically, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or Harry Potter cloak of invisibility, what have you. Just a ship, it's on a ship instead of a person or a level 3 warlock. And this gets Lovecraftian pretty quickly. And it's a story that I think, you know, if you consider yourself a conspiracy realist, this is probably one of your favorite stories when you're growing up.
Ben, is it any accident that the ship was named the USS Eldridge?
It's great for the story.
It really works. It really works.
And this is a real ship, by the way. We'll get into this too. That part
it's
is
It's spelled differently. It's spelled Eldridge.
Yes, good point. So according to the story, this experiment is unusual in comparison to other declassified experiments, because it is witnessed by hundreds, possibly thousands of sailors who are at the port or who are on other nearby ships. the testing was a series of events, and it began, as Matt said, in the summer of 43. At first, it seemed successful to a limited extent. One test allegedly resulted in the Eldridge becoming kind of translucent, you know, somewhat obscured, almost invisible. And then some witnesses reported a, quote, greenish fog, or later described as a green glow, appearing in place of where the ship used to be. Crew members allegedly complained of severe nausea, and then disaster struck.
And just, you know, while we're here, if any of that is true, it sounds like nuclear stuff to me.
A greenish fog, glow. You say?
Yeah. People are getting dosed by radiation and feeling a little sick. Yeah. That's what it sounds like.
It also reminds me a lot of when David Copperfield made the Statue of Liberty disappear on live television, minus the radiation and the greenish glow. Apparently, he just pulled a giant, like, curtain up and then dropped it. But that was a big deal at the time.
I vaguely remember that. Yeah. Yeah. I always wondered how he did that. And also, unrelated, I always wonder how people get into those sorts of gigs, you know, like just from a infrastructure, equipment, materials.
Practice, angle. Practice, practice. Same way you get to Carnegie Hall, you know.
You start with a spoon and you end up with the Statue of Liberty.
It's you just crazy. Pick a real specific niche and just go with it. Lean into it hard.
I'm a magician, but I only disappear statues. Yes, that's my power. Exactly.
Guys, I'm being serious here. I mean, think about the fog even. Like, what could that be? Oh, I don't know. Someone trying to figure out how to make a piece of uranium go into water and then, I don't know, use the steam that's coming off of it to make some experiment happen, but they don't understand exactly what's happening yet with all that steam.
And we know now, from what was soon to follow, radioactive energy creation is all about steam. And we know that the water and all of that stuff that is used to generate radioactive energy is absolutely toxic.
Yes, but we're not saying that that's what was happening here. This is Matt's little silly pet theory.
And okay. This has been Matt's Silly Pet Theory Corner.
I think it's neither little nor silly. There are other couple possibilities.
It is a corner, though. Can we at least agree on that?
I think it's a corner. Sure. Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, we're in your corner in multiple levels. So one of the things that could have happened is if there were some sort of energy field or distortion that affected perception, the Eldridge probably had lights on it, right? So those lights may have been somehow distorted, producing what appeared to be a greenish glow. Anyhow, he said disaster struck. We'll get into the details of the legend, but here's the general gist of what happened. The crew had severe side effects. Some died. These side effects were much more than just an upset stomach. Some were allegedly found materialized partway into the hull of the ship, fused into it, like phasing that went wrong.
I'm sorry, Ben, I can't get over every time you say the Eldritch, I'm just picturing Cthulhu-esque hulking monsters coming out of the sea.
Wait for it. Yeah, and also I perhaps unfairly primed us by immediately saying Lovecraftian.
Oh, no, it was completely fair.
So, it's okay. Well, the other thing is, just so everybody understands, phasing, just so we're all on the same page here. Phasing is when you have a creature on the board and they're in play for turn one, basically, let's say, and then it comes to your turn again after your opponent has played, and then they would phase out. So you'd flip them over. Then on your next turn, they would phase back in. So you'd flip it back over and they could attack and block and things like that.
Which is based on the Philadelphia experiment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, and also, of course, for any fans of comics, we know that is the primary power of Kitty Pryde, and is one of the many powers of Vision, who is a synthezoid.
What was Kitty Pryde's actual superhero name? Was that it?
Shadowcat.
Shadowcat. Thank you. Just making sure.
So this we're making light of this, but if true, this is an enormous tragedy because it means hundreds of people saw multiple folks die in a way that appeared to be physically impossible. Some simply disappeared and were never seen again. And still others, how Lovecraftian is this, were driven mad by the experience, by whatever they saw, on the inside of that energy field, or they were plagued for years by mysterious cases of, quote, phasing in and out of existence. The Navy disavowed all knowledge of this. You can read their statement about it, which is low-key hilarious.
Nah, dog, that didn't happen.
Right. But since the mid-50s, not 1943, since about the mid-50s, the story grew legs in the public sphere. More and more authors came forward claiming to have either second or firsthand knowledge of the event. And at times, their various different stories about what happened in 1943 contradict one another in numerous ways.
Yeah, in 1956 is when a ufologist by the name of Morris Jessup got letters from a person identifying himself as Carlos Miguel Allende or Carl M. Allen. And let's just really quickly remind everyone that this was about 12 years after the experiment allegedly took place.
Oh, man, these letters. Oh, boy. Okay, so if you have ever, just to make this human and relatable, if you have ever been in a situation where you have published a book or you've created art or music or something where something that people respond to, then you might be familiar with the out of the blue extraordinary correspondence. That's what we'll call it, extraordinary correspondence. We get it here at this show, and for the most part, we love it. And we're very fortunate to receive these letters. But here's what Carlos slash Carl claims in his letters. His government name is Carl Allen, by the way. He just goes by Carlos Allende. So Carl says that he witnessed this secret experiment, 1943, World War II, at the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard. He was not on the Eldridge, he says. He was on a nearby ship, the Furoseth, and he was watching the Eldridge, and he saw he had learned through this experience and through his own later investigations that the ship didn't just disappear, didn't just become invisible for a little bit, but it got teleported to New York in a way that was physically impossible given what we understand about ship propulsion at the time. And then it got teleported to another dimension wherein the crew encountered sentient non-human life. Then it got teleported through time. This is a dangerous journey. And that's what led to the deaths of several men. And Carlos slash Carl is the one who claimed, you know, they saw the greenish glow. People were fused to the ship. He also said he saw a guy, a survivor of the Eldridge, later in a bar. And as he watched the man vanished from existence. Ooh.
And really quickly, I'm certain that these accounts are the inspiration for the 1984 sci-fi film, The Philadelphia Experiment, where some sailors who were on board when this experiment took place get teleported to the Nevada desert, and then things get weird.
Mm-hmm. And Carl was, it's important to say, Carl, as we'll learn, was a guy who was a fan of sending letters. But it made sense for him to reach out to this guy, Jessup, because Jessup had just published a book called The Case for the UFO. It's kind of like a primer and speculation, examining UFO phenomena in general, and then speculating on things like what their propulsion system could be. Like, how could they be so nimble?
Defy physics, basically.
Right, yeah. Right, yeah, just so. Eventually, Carl would end up sending Jessup more than 50 letters. And Jessup at first, so here's the thing. You might think, okay, Jessup just automatically dismisses this guy out of hand because he makes some crazy claims. He also, by the way, I can't remember if we mentioned this. He also, by the way, told Jessup in the course of these letters that he had personally spent several weeks with Albert Einstein, and Albert Einstein was explaining in person the truth about the unified field and various other bleeding edge of physics kind of subjects.
God, it sucks, because how cool would that be? I mean, it sounds amazing. But everyone out there listening, you know, we've encountered stories like this before where you have to remain skeptical enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're all doing that right now. It doesn't mean we completely disbelieve, all of us at least, but it does mean that we're venturing into some choppy waters here.
Right. Well said. Yeah. Well, Jessup is taking the same tack. Initially, he says, okay, I'm going to try to seriously investigate these claims, these ideas in good faith. But he becomes frustrated because this Carl guy, this person he knows only through letters, seems unable to or unwilling to produce physical evidence. Eventually, Jessup dismisses all these missives as the work of a crackpot or someone who has having some cognitive stability issues, and he goes about his day. That was in, what was that, 1955, 56. Mm-hmm. He's fine. He's like, okay, well, that was weird.
But then,
1957, he gets another weird piece of correspondence.
Yeah, not from a UFO guy, crackpot, from the Office of Naval Research in Washington, D.C. They reach out to him, and they're a little bit annoyed. They'd gotten a package containing a paperback version of the case for the UFO. It was in a manila envelope marked Happy Easter.
Oh.
And the book had been marked up extensively.
Oh, yes. It reminds me of something, honestly, my grandfather would do. There were three different shades of pink that had been just all written, scribbled throughout there. And it appeared to show correspondence between three individual people, one of whom is named Jemmy. That's J-E-M-I. And the O and R labeled the other two as simply Mr. A and Mr. B.
You got to call them something. You know what I mean? Let's not complicate it. I'm sure they had a whole list of names and they're like Lancelot, Galahad, Mansa Musa. And someone else said, okay, dude, calm down. We'll start at A.
Exactly.
So these notes are interesting. We believe that one of the reasons Carl Allen specifically contacted Jessup originally was because in his book, The Case for the UFO, he mentions Einstein and he mentions unified field. And Carl Allen had either spent a lot of time with Einstein or had thought about him pretty frequently. So in these notes, and these are heavy notes, by the way, in these notes, there are oblique references to the Philadelphia experiment. And there are also, like, if you look at it, the way they're written, it's almost as if there is a chat forum. It looks almost as if these people were passing this book back and forth to one another and reacting to the things the other people said.
And then we get like almost like a Hitchcockian twist where Jessup notices something. And like I can picture the editing cross, you know, like doing a voiceover from the past or like a flashback to when he first noticed this. He recognizes the handwriting.
Of all three people, because it's one person, it's that guy who sent him all those letters. And now he's got jammed up by the Navy. This is not what you imagine happening when you want to write a cool UFO book. So
this guy jammed himself up by sending it over to the Navy.
No,
but is now jamming up Jessup.
Yeah, Jessup is unfairly jammed here. He recognizes this handwriting and he recognizes the subject matter, the style of writing. He says, look, this is all that same guy who's been sending me stuff. And naval authorities, I assure you, I think he's kind of off. He says, has some interesting things to say. Oh, by the way, he's also a close friend of Albert Einstein. Why are you talking to me?
Just died, right? This was like, yeah.
Just about 2 years ago. Einstein died in 55 and this is 57. So that's what he says. He's like, look, I don't know. I'm just trying to make a living as a writer. It's tough all around, but I have nothing to do with this. He probably also went on to say, like, I'm also not a communist in case that comes up. And then he goes off and he's still now he's like now. If you think about it from Jessup's perspective, the Navy calling you up about this story that you originally might not have believed, that becomes a huge piece of credibility, does it not? Especially, there's another twist here. This is a twist that I think will be a big one. The Office of Naval Research itself later funded a very small republication of Jessup's book through a military contractor called Varro.
Why?
I don't know, man, because when they republished it, it wasn't just Jessup's work. They published it with all of those annotations by those three fake people.
Double why?
Right.
Utopia, anyone? Still, oh God, it's usually in my mind. Sorry, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
Oh, and thanks to everybody who wrote in and alerted us to the British version being up there, being available.
Watched
now.
Both seasons already. Do yep. it now.
Is
What's
it good?
The verdict?
Yes, that's all. That's all it is. Yes.
Do you prefer it to the US version?
In many ways. In other ways, no. And I'm not going to elaborate.
So don't take our word for it. If you want to check out Utopia, now's the perfect time to do it. We're going to pause for a word from our sponsors, and we're going to watch the rest of the seasons. Then we'll be back and we'll do the show. And we're back. This is one heck of a tale so far. This is, I mean, step to the left, Rime of the Ancient Mariner. We have a new legend of the sea. So let's dive further into these claims. The numerous authors writing about this in later years link the experiment to other pre-existing conspiracy theories regarding particularly Allied and Axis experimentation on the bleeding edges of known science during World War II. And the thing about that stuff is, as crazy as it sounds, there is a little bit of sand to some of those World War II conspiracy theories. Shout out to the Horton HO, right? That might have changed the war. We really lucked out. This also became the Philadelphia experiment writers also connected it to later conspiracies, such as things like the Montauk Project, which we haven't done an episode on that, I think. But if we do, it's going to be kind of the part two of the Philadelphia experiment.
Mm-hmm. And we see something happening here with the story of the Philadelphia experiment that we're seeing a lot more of in modern times, actually, extremely recent times, where some of the authors who were writing about it are willing to make leaps in logic and almost just assume that certain stories are real and then find connective tissue between those two stories in some, you know, small way, as Ben was saying, like to the Montauk Project. But it seems as though a lot of the authors writing about it were just willing to do that. And then there it becomes a thing where the lore builds up over time, where more and more people are stating kind of the same thing that hasn't been proven, but enough people are saying it that it feels true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a social aspect to it, a social engineering aspect. And there were these common story elements, the ones we outlined in our exploration of the legend. There were plenty of contradictory claims as people got their favorite, you know, pet theory corners stoked. And one thing you'll notice is that the authors often paint Carlos Allende or Carl Allen as this very mysterious, enigmatic figure, a drifter on the fringes of the mainstream, a man nearly impossible to contact. This turned out to be very much not true.
Interesting. I mean, that's certainly the way it seems to come off in terms of the assembled lore around this story, right?
Yeah, picture him like he's the popular mythic image of this guy would be a lot like the father in Firestarter, you know, on the run from the government, mysterious men in black chasing you for your rare and dangerous knowledge and or abilities. So this drew the attention of a paranormal researcher named Robert Gorman. Around 1979 or so, Gorman was looking back through this stuff, and he noticed something weird. The original return address on that Easter package that was sent to the Office of Naval Research was from New Kensington, Pennsylvania. Holy smokes, says Rob. That's my hometown. I live here. I can find this address. And the coincidences got even stranger. This guy, Carlos Allende, his real name was Carl Allen. He lived in town. He was the son of a close family friend of the Gormans. So Gorman was able to reach Carl Allen with relatively little difficulty. That means something profoundly changed over the course of all those other writers' experience, or that means that maybe they weren't trying as hard to contact him as they led their readers to believe.
But he was known around town. He had a reputation for being a bit of a loner with sort of a wild imagination, correct?
Yes, that is correct. He was an eccentric. He was infamous for writing on anything and everything around the family house. And as Skeptoid puts it, he was also known to send bizarre writing and claims to everyone in his family or in his circle for any occasion. And there's a word for this. It's called hypergraphia, a behavioral condition characterized by the intense desire to write or draw.
Ben, this instantly makes me think of Lovecraftian stuff, where someone who has lost their mind holed up in some sort of ramshackled abandoned mansion scrawls weird Cthulhu-esque cryptograms all over the wall. Does it not?
That's a good point. I didn't think of that. Yeah. Yeah, I think we're well on the way to making our own version of the Philadelphia Experiment as a feature film, or maybe a series of YouTube videos. All right, well,
love it.
We'll workshop it. So, look, Gorman, he's tracking Carl down, but at the same time, he's looking into the facts surrounding the USS Eldridge.
And really, what he was finding appeared to illustrate a very different picture than what he was being given by old Carl. He found a lot of the stuff fully disproved the statements that Carl was making. And perhaps in another way, if you, listening, are fully convinced that this was a true story, that Carl knew the truth, and everyone else was keeping it quiet, it might lead you down the road of, oh, this is a full cover-up and it was effective, it worked, and the lone person that knew the truth was seen as a crackpot.
Typical for these sorts of tales, right?
Yeah, the absence of evidence can be treated as evidence, you know, which is tough to get around. Gorman found the following. Based on U.S. naval records, the ship, the Eldridge, was nowhere near Philadelphia at the time this experiment was said to have occurred. Not only were they not there, but they had evidence, corroborated evidence, of the routine stuff they were doing and where they were at the time.
They could fake all that if they wanted to. Just saying.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. That's true. We have to pursue both lines of thought here. It could be faked, right? You can change history. It's just a matter of changing records and eliminating witnesses. So he reaches out to people who would have been firsthand witnesses. Who was a crew member on the Eldridge in 43, he thinks, who was on board afterwards or even before, if I could find someone still alive. Every single person, crew member that he spoke to and was on board the ship there, none recalled anything about any such experiment. And Matt, this is where we have to say they could have been intimidated into
silence.
That's
exactly. They could have been intimidated, or maybe they lost consciousness. They don't actually remember it. And the horror stories are, you know, of people who didn't make it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, have to say that.
We have to say it. It's the fair thing to acknowledge. And so, long story short, every claim that Gorman looked into, it appeared that the vast majority of them came from one source, Carl Allen, and the rest of it was rephrased or embellished afterwards. And additionally, all of these claims that he looked into seemed to be easily disproven by multiple other sources, which again would have to be compromised or faked for this to be real at this point. But there are other troubling facts. Let's go back to the bar. Carl Allen, remember, he says, I saw this guy, a survivor of those tragic events in 43. He was in a bar with me, and then poof, he just Kaiser Soze'd, or Nightcrawler bamfed, teleported, something. There's more news on that, though.
Yeah, there were quite a few people that came forward claiming to be this person, and not just regular people, veterans of the Eldridge and the USS Engstrom, which was moored alongside the Eldridge in 1943. We have to note that these kinds of claims were made well after the Philadelphia Experiment became the pop culture phenomenon that it is today. And in more than one case, it actually turned out that these guys were not really veterans at all. So it really kind of throws a wrench into the works here and doesn't necessarily fully debunk Carl Allen's initial story, because it seems like the people that are coming forward making these claims are also being a little dishonest themselves, right?
Yeah. And it's a phenomenon that you see whenever a story gets a grip on the national consciousness. Like whenever there is a suspected or acknowledged serial killer in operating in a city. Often law enforcement gets inundated with calls from people who are, for one reason or another, either falsely claiming to be the killer, falsely claiming to know who it is, et cetera, et cetera. And some of these folks are pranksters. Some of these folks are maybe a little more detached from reality. But there's another huge badger in the bag here. It's the one we have to keep going back to. It's the missing piece of the puzzle. Why on earth did the Office of Naval Research call Jessup in the first place? Why did they go to him and not just toss this in the rubbish bin? There are a couple of possibilities. Two, I would say, are pretty mundane. And one, I would say, is... that's what I say. It's...
yeah.
I'm shaking okay. my finger.
I'll go with you down this route. So I would say the first one is that whatever individuals from that office that ended up making it to see Jessup were just doing it because they wanted to do it. They were interested. They got this weird correspondence and they're like, I kind of want to know more. I mean, I wonder if this guy's like annotating his own book and sending it to us. Let's go talk to him. This will be fun. Come on, Bill. Let's go.
No, that's a really good point, because like the fact that it's a government agency, your mind immediately goes toward this as some sort of giant initiative. But these people have pretty unilateral abilities to pursue their own stuff, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a really good point.
I love the idea for this one. I love the idea of Jessup going to meet them. And they're like, actually, we're not meeting in the office. We're just come meet me at this coffee shop over here.
We're really just fans. We're really just, you
really
know, we're fans.
Just want to ask if you would sign this.
We're thinking about doing a small run.
Exactly. Would you be interested in optioning this? Because we're actually deciding we're going to pivot careers. We're going to be like producers now.
A lot of people, you know, have this stereotype of us as these uptight guys, but we like to kick back, fire a few rail guns, work on some alien tech, and pursue pictures. This is going to be big for us, Jessup, or should I say Jemmy? Dun, dun.
and then he's just like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Is fire a few rails a euphemism for doing cocaine? I'm sorry. I'm just back to that.
I think so.
Again from earlier. Never mind.
Railgun. Oh boy, that's another hidden history. So that's the first possibility, and it may be mundane, but it is totally possible. The second is that it could have literally just been these guys' job. It was a small. I think it was a couple of people. It was a couple of officials. So maybe their remit was to follow up on any and all correspondence, no matter how weird it was, no matter how innocuous, no matter how unimportant it might seem. Like maybe they were treating this with the same kind of due diligence they would treat a letter from a six-year-old about Santa Claus. Maybe they just had to reply to everything and investigate it if it merited further investigation. So they may not have had any personal interest.
Oh, I could see that.
Or
what else could there be?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so what if they had to read this? They had to read the whole book, and there was something in those notes. There was something in those notes that was somehow similar to actual classified research Uncle Sam was conducting. Think about that. That's not as impossible as it sounds, because there are a ton of notes there. And depending on what they're talking about, if there's even one note that seems like a legit hint that someone outside of the company knows what the Navy's up to,
bad times.
Shivers.
Yeah.
And we have to be real about this. Even if, let's say, Carl Allende, his writing, his notes, his theories, all that stuff was complete bunk. But in that writing, he like hit upon, as Ben is saying, something that's close enough to what was occurring somewhere. Maybe if it wasn't even there, but just through a conceptualized science fiction story, he got close enough, they would, I can imagine that being dangerous and them having to go, like you said, and follow up on
it. Oh, I mean, look at how much science fiction is so prescient of like future technology. You know, I mean, that's where a lot of like the idea of futurism comes from, is like thought experiments that ultimately become possible. And then this is the part, I'm sorry, there's so many beats in this story that are just so Lovecraftian. And I know you primed the pump, Ben, but on April 30th, Jessup took his own life, presumably after succumbing to eldritch madness, or potentially considering himself a failure as a writer.
Yeah, this story haunted him, and he did die by his own hand just 2 years after that initial contact with the Navy.
I have to say it. He died 2 years after this interaction with the ONR. There's potential for something to feel fishy there.
No doubt. Doesn't
mean that it is, but it definitely feels weird.
Yeah, we have to put it in. Much, much later, the story continues. The 1984 film, The Philadelphia Experiment, is released. And in 1988, a man named Al Bielek, sees the film. And it shakes some things loose in his head. He goes public and says, I was there. I was on the Eldritch. I was part of that experiment. I had been brainwashed to forget it. And seeing this film jogged those memories loose. Interesting. Not the same thing as proof. Interesting. Carlos Allende, Carl Allen, lived until 1994. He would send letters to any number of people every so often about the Philadelphia experiment, further exploring the story and the legend. And the same year that Carl passes away, a French writer named Jacques F. Vallee, V-A-L-L-E-E, publishes this article in the Journal of Scientific Exploration called Anatomy of a Hoax, The Philadelphia Experiment 50 Years Later. And he receives this letter from a guy named Edward Dudgeon. Edward Dudgeon, U.S. Navy vet, 1942-1945. He has a story that relates to the Eldritch.
Kind of similarly to one of the other stories we heard earlier, as someone being on board a near ship. That's the one that Carlos Allende initially put forward. He was on this other ship. He observed some of this and then went down the rabbit hole. Well, this person, Edward Dudgeon, says that he served aboard the Engstrom, the USS Engstrom. It was dry docked in Philadelphia Naval Yard. If the Philadelphia experiment is to be true, that's also where the Eldritch was. And he is saying that both ships, while they were there and docked and preparing to operate, had some kind of classified tech on board. But according to his story, he wasn't saying that this was some kind of invisibility experiment, like some kind of cloaking device, nor some kind of teleportation device or something designed by extraterrestrials.
Yeah, exactly. Instead, he said they were attempting to scramble magnetic signatures of ships using something called degaussing. This is a way of counteracting a ship's magnetic field to establish a condition making the ship seem invisible to certain devices.
To radar and things like that, not to the eye. Right.
Right, right. To protect it from magnetic torpedoes, for instance.
But
you'll still see the ship if you're in line of sight. So what he says is they wrapped the ship with large cables and zapped it with high voltage charges. So the ship, again, it wouldn't be invisible to, quick clarification, would not be invisible to line of sight witnesses. It wouldn't be invisible to radar, but it would appear to be invisible to magnetic torpedoes, the kinds that were used by U-boats.
Interesting. So what about the green glow that was such an interesting feature of the early reports of this experiment?
So Dudgeon says it's either St. Elmo's fire or an electric storm. But St. Elmo's fire is kind of weird. It's a glow that occasionally appears around pointy objects during storms. But from what I understand, that glow is supposed to be blue in color, not green.
Yeah. Again, if the original account is true whatsoever.
Yes, good right? point.
Because the green glow is just a part of the story, the lore there. And then, you know, this person is coming forward saying, well, I was actually there. And yeah, there was tech and it was for this. So that's really all he's confirming.
Yeah. He has a good, an interesting explanation about that apparently impossible time that the Eldridge allegedly took to go to Norfolk and then return to Philadelphia. He says the Navy was using inland canals that are off limits to civilian vessels, and that allowed them to make the trip in 6 hours instead of 2 days. But anyway, what we're saying is there are other people who are proposing more grounded explanations to these alleged events. What happened to the ship, though? We've been pretty clear. The ship is real. The ship did exist, and people were crewed on it. It was commissioned. It was an active vessel in the Navy until eventually it was sold for scrap, just like the Sea Shadow in the 1990s. Doesn't that seem weird, though? I guess.
Yep.
Yes, what? It does. Am I being too sentimental, you guys? I would feel like maybe it's the improv mentality coming out, but like if we built some awesome, super secret technology, even if it was outdated, I would be like, come on, guys, this is more than a war machine now. It's like it's like a testament to our friendship and all the cool work we did traveling dimensions and
making— Yes, and there's no reason we should destroy this. Yes, and what, let's put it on display.
Right?
I do have to point out really quickly, my dear friend, who I believe both of you have met, Peyton Fisher of Brooklyn, New York, he pointed out that the Wikipedia intro for the Philadelphia experiment, he describes it as stinging. He says, I love the stinging Wikipedia intro. Quote, the alleged claims do not conform to known physical laws.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah. There you go.
Burn.
It's true. Hey. It's true.
I was going to say, sometimes they don't, guys.
No,
that's when it gets exciting.
Agreed.
Well, I think there's also a there's a real cool thing you can do on Wikipedia, especially if you're looking at a subject you feel is controversial. Hop on over to the talk tab, right? Every article starts with one tab that just says article, but to the direct right of that, you'll see the tab that says talk. And if you get into the right thing, you will find these amazing arguments by very dedicated people. Oddly enough, you would think the geopolitical stuff would have more involved, acrimonious kind of exchanges, but the fan fiction things are where you see people packing a lot of rhetorical heat. But yeah, you're right, stinging accusation, and the ship is gone. It was scrapped in the 1990s. As of this recording, if you check with the Office of Naval Research today, they will tell you they have never conducted experiments on invisibility and that this sort of technology remains squarely in the realm of science fiction. However, this is not entirely true. Something like invisibility tech is currently being researched by various outfits around the planet. We just don't know of anything good enough to do what Carl Allen claimed Uncle Sam did back in the 40s. But Google quantum stealth invisibility. It's a cool read.
Or the kind of weird, like, functional, painty version of invisibility called dazzle camouflage, where ships were painted with these, like, weird angular stripes that supposedly made them harder to see on the horizon line.
Yeah. That was cool, too. Do check that out. And as we get to the end of the show, we know there is one huge piece of the puzzle. It's a piece we cannot ignore. It's one that's
definitely
doubtlessly been on all of our minds for most of this episode. It's the real question. Where the hell does Philadelphia cream cheese actually come from? It is not Philadelphia.
What?
It's not Philadelphia. We don't know. There may be consequences for us disclosing this on air. But cream cheese was invented in the 1870s by a guy in Chester, New York. He's the first to mass produce it, at least. His name's William Lawrence.
Yeah, but Philadelphia, they're the ones that got really good at it and, you know, figured out how to make it taste like strawberries, right?
You know, I'm not going to take that one from you, Noel. I'm gonna let you have that.
Okay, the
funny thing is, this is just so unrelated to anything. He called it Philadelphia cream cheese because he thought it sounded classier and fancier, because at the time, Philadelphia was well known for the quality of its dairy industry.
Sure. But it's still something that Philly residents sort of hold on to as like a point of pride.
Yeah, I think it only really checks out if he had a Southern accent, because Philadelphia, it really is lovely.
So that's our show. Unfortunately, at this point, it does appear that the majority of the really out there claims linked to the Philadelphia experiment can be traced to a single man, Carl Allen. Additionally, the majority of his claims do not seem to hold up to scrutiny, and they can either be disproven or they just can't be corroborated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as we record today, multiple government agencies do continue classified research across a wide range of disciplines. Just last week, it was reported that the Navy has gone public about several of these classified patents.
Yeah, it's true. And you can read about this right now. A great resource we found was on The Drive. They've got I guess it's kind of an imprint within whatever The Drive is called The War Zone. And there's just some great articles coming out of there. Brett Tingley and Tyler Rogaway are two authors that we've been reading a ton off of that website lately. And you can even find, like, there are great helpful things here in these articles, like a Google patent search with specifically the Salvatore Paez guy on here. It's a key name that you can look up as you're doing your own research. You can see all of the actual patents for crazy stuff.
Wow. I still want to see the patent for the e-meter that Mike Render told us about.
Mm-hmm. There's something very interesting afoot here with these patents. That's why we shout out the Invention Secrecy Act of 51, which remains in effect today. Essentially, the folks that the journalists are talking to over at the War Zone have confirmed that the U.S. government spent more than $500,000 over 3 years to test some theories that every other physicist says are pseudoscience. So what is the truth here? And when do we find out? And still, why was the ONR so interested in this story? We have no idea. What do you think? Please let us know. We try to be easy to find online. We're on Facebook. Go over to Here's Where It Gets Crazy to meet the best part of the show, your fellow listeners. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram, not just as a show, but as individuals.
That's right. If you would like, you can find me on Instagram, where I am at @HowNowNoelBrown.
Matt_Jimbei-Frederick _
The Bongo Boy.
A.K.A. TheCreamCornKid.org.
Yep.
So you can also find me at Ben Bullen HSW on Twitter. You can reach out to me directly at Ben Bullen on Instagram. I hate social media, you're saying, shaking your fist into the sky. But I have a story I need to tell you. We have good news for you, my friend.
That's right. You can call 1-833-STDWYTK and leave a message at the sound of Ben's dulcet tones.
That is correct. We very much look forward to hearing from you. We are a bit behind. Hey, we're catching up and we're getting there quickly. Please try and limit it to one message if you can and keep it as brief as you can. Give us all that important information right up front. Hammer it home and we will hopefully get you on the air on one of our listener mail episodes. Just let us know if you don't want us to play your voice or you don't want us to say your name on the air. One other thing here. We don't have much, if any, Wikipedia presence as a show.
Oh, yeah. Guys. What's that about?
Well, I think we have one mention on an old How Stuff Works entry.
Yes.
With the How Stuff Works podcast. I'm just putting this out there. Hey, are you listening to this and a wiki editor? I don't know. Put something on there. We'd love to see even a silly entry. I don't know.
Am I incorrect to assume that a lot of Wikipedia entries are done by the parties involved themselves?
I think that's true, or maybe a PR agency some people hire, but I don't feel like it's ethical.
Well, we don't play that way, do we?
No.
No.
And I'm surprised, Matt. I'm surprised you bring this up because some doors don't close. So
yeah, they better not close.
Situation.
We're going to live forever on the wiki.
But please, no stinging opening lines, if you would.
And if none of that quite sends the ship of your mind hurtling through dimensions and time, there is one other way you can always contact us. Regardless of where you're at, what you think about the Philadelphia experiment, or every other little thing under and beyond the sun, that is our good old-fashioned email address where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.